Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
Thank you for joining us for Pepperdine People. I'm Pete Peterson from the School of Public Policy, and I'm joined today by Troy Senek, a senior fellow at the Center for Individual Freedom and an editor at the website ricochet.com. I am speaking with Troy today about an article he wrote for City Journal, specifically their spring 2012 edition entitled The Worst Union in America. And Troy, it's great to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Pete.
The worst union in America is the California Teachers Association, and the beginning of your piece demonstrates that this has not always been the worst union in America. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit as you begin your essay, looking back at the past, going back half a century to look at the rather illustrious history and supportive history for the CTA, the California Teachers Association for Education here in California. And then we'll transition a little bit into how and why that's changed.
Okay, well, the piece starts out with a portrait of a California Teachers Association that's very, very different than the one that exists today. It starts 50 years ago with a speech given in 1962 by the president of the CTA at the time, a gentleman by the name of Arthur Corey. I'll read you the quote from the speech that's included in the article. "The strike as a weapon for teachers is inappropriate, unprofessional, illegal, outmoded, and ineffective. You can't go out on an illegal strike one day and expect to go back to your classroom and teach good citizenship the next." And then immediately in the piece, that is juxtaposed with a rally, a protest almost 50 years later, in May of 2011, where you have CTA members protesting inside the state capitol in Sacramento, being arrested, handing out pamphlets that are exhorting people to shut down major thoroughfares, to harass politicians, to boycott companies that support education reform, and doing all this in a week where their students were back in class taking their most important standardized exams of the year, which tells you how much the culture of the organization changed in 50 years' time.
Now, that transition happened over a period of years, but there was a specific point that, again, you cite in this piece in 1975 when our then and current Governor Jerry Brown signed the ROTA Act, which enabled California teachers to bargain collectively. Tell us a little bit about that turning point. Again, this we're now looking back at 1975 and how that really changed the dynamics within the union and increased their power.
Well, what happens after the ROTA Act is passed is that you see a massive surge in the number of local CTA chapters that move to collective bargaining. The numbers swell, and most importantly, as a result of that, money pours in because the California Teachers Association requires that its members pay dues, and the dues can be used by the union however they see fit. They do not require previous approval from the members. And as a result, the CTA becomes a major political force, and this starts in sort of a grassroots fashion with local school board elections, where because there is such a surplus of interest amongst the members of the union and a deficit amongst the rest of the population, you get the CTA in a pretty convenient position for them, which is picking their own bosses, choosing who is going to be making policy at the local level in the schools. And that's how it starts. And then you see it in the 80s and well into the 90s and today swell into a massive political machine that is now no longer just operating at the grassroots, but really exerting its financial and political muscle when it comes to elections statewide.
Now, one of the interesting parts of the history that you cite in the piece is that not only does this political influence range from the grassroots, local level, school board, so on and so forth, and through elective offices at a variety of levels. But because California has its initiative and referendum system, that has been a new sandbox, if you will, a new policy sandbox for the CTA to play in. And over the last few decades, they have really showed their power in both supporting and working against certain initiatives, both in the realm of education policy, but also beyond. Why don't we just take a look first at, in areas of education policy, a couple of the one or two big issues that the CTA has really weighed in on.
Sure. Well, the two biggest consistently in the last couple of decades have been school vouchers and paycheck protection, which is the idea of keeping the union members from having to send their dues to the union and have them used for political purposes against their will, or at least without their consent. The CTA has poured tons of money into each of these initiatives. In fact, in 2005, when paycheck protection was one of the aspects of Governor Schwarzenegger's reform campaign as part of the initiatives for that year, they went so far as to mortgage their headquarters in Sacramento in order to underwrite it. There are some stories that go into some depth in the piece, but just to give you an idea, in the early 90s when the school voucher fight was on, there were horrible stories of, first of all, the president of the union saying publicly that some things are so evil they shouldn't go on the ballot. That was as a way of justifying the members of the union who had been publicly intimidating people physically, who had been falsifying signatures on ballots in order to keep the voucher measure from qualifying. And there are a couple of stories that I tell in the piece about one member of the pro-voucher campaign who was offered $400,000 to stop circulating petitions by somebody with connections to the union, and another who, after a debate on the issue, was run off the road or attempted – they attempted to run him off the road, the person that he had been debating just moments before from the union. And unfortunately, that is broadly representative of the roughest edges of the unions and how aggressive they can be on these issues because they see their self-interest at stake.
I think that's one of the unique aspects of public sector unions in general, and you get into some very very important statistics around this, but the ability for these unions, especially unions like the CTA, to automatically withdraw a certain percentage of the paychecks of their members, a membership which has doubled over the last 30 or so years, that has really put together a, for lack of a better way of putting it, a war chest of funds in well over $100 million that can then be employed in some of these political exercises.
Right, all of which is tax-free, we should note, because of the way they're organized.
So one of the things, just to bring it up to today, we have Prop 32 on the ballot this coming November here in California. That is another attempt at paycheck protection, again, a way of separating or at least giving the option to public sector union members and folks that work for corporations. It should be noted that Prop 32 is really meant for both corporations and unions, but will allow public sector union members to have more freedom as to whether they will designate some of their salary to political causes. Any thoughts on the prospects for that and how the CTA has been working against this upcoming measure?
Well, they've thrown an excess of money as you might expect, because all the evidence from other states where this has happened shows that this tends to be the death knell for major unions if this kind of reform passes. As far as the prospects for the initiative, we're sitting here recording this at the end of September. The most recent polling out of the Public Policy Institute of California has a no vote, which would keep the status quo, winning, but winning within the margin of error. So it's going to be extremely close. There's a good aspect to that and a bad aspect to it. The good aspect is it tells you that reforming the public sector in California is not beyond the pale, that there is still sufficient support amongst the electorate to at least make it a close-run thing. The bad news is, which I suspect we will see in the next few weeks, is this will engender an avalanche of money from the unions because they see this as the decisive battle in this campaign. So we'll see. But the implications for the future of California, particularly in the public sector, could not be bigger than they are in the fight over Prop 32.
I think one of the most – and we'll close in with this. I think one of the most poignant pieces of your essay – and again, this is The Worst Union in America in the spring 2012 issue of City Journal – is when you talk about the influence of unions – not just at the local level, but within school systems or school districts that are ostensibly meant to serve both minority and economically challenged populations. And so much of, I think, what the general public understands as being the importance of public education is that it's really meant to provide the same level of education whether you're coming from a wealthy district or a poor one. And you tell some very powerful stories about how unions have played a role in really preventing kids in these both minority and economically challenged districts from getting the education that they should. And maybe if you could specifically tell the story of Locke High School and what happened there in Los Angeles.
Sure. Locke High School was founded in 1967 in response to the Watts riots. And the idea animating the school was similar to what you were just mentioning. There was a very sort of egalitarian mindset about it. That this was – the idea was that Watts was someplace that was so downtrodden and that was so hopeless for the students that were there that this school would be a beacon of hope. And it's an entirely minority population school. It's all either African American or Hispanic, very low income, and was an utter failure. Was falling apart, and they brought in an African-American principal in the middle of the last decade who got very serious about reform, raised test scores, raised classroom performance, stopped one of the most pernicious trends on campus, which was the pervasive violence. There's a story in the piece about a gang fight that broke out, and he did something that had never occurred to anybody before, which is he took all 80 students that were involved and expelled them. Mm. The idea being that students and faculty and staff needed to understand that somebody was in control and that there was going to be somebody at the head of the ship who cared about the future of the school and the future of the students. Unfortunately for the principal, the way that this story ends on his end was that he began advocating to have Locke turned into a charter school, which met with strong resistance from the unions and their affiliated teachers. The things that the union did in response, I mean, some of them beggar belief. You had teachers filing a grievance for the fact that he required them to come to class bringing lesson plans. Mm. That tells you how debased the entire system was.
Right.
And he ended up, because of allegations that they were improperly circulating petitions for it to become a charter school during the school day, during class time, he ended up being escorted off of campus by three police officers and given a cubicle in the district where he was paid $600 a day to do nothing. So that tells you how powerful the movement against reform is within the union. Now, happily, in the case of Locke, well, the principal was a casualty of that process. Green Dot came over and transformed the school into a charter school. And 4 years later, their numbers were through the roof by contrast to where they had been before. It's a remarkable story of what is possible when the union influence is shed. And as importantly, because while the union influence can be overwhelmingly negative, it still falls to the people who administer the school afterwards to serve the students as best they can and to avoid the policies that lead to the rot in these schools when the unions are in control. And they've done a fantastic job with that at Locke, and it's a model that you'd love to see replicated in poor urban school districts throughout California.
Now, we'll close with maybe a little bit more of an upbeat note.
Yes.
I mean, there are some things that we've touched on a little bit that bode at least slightly well. One of them, again, is Prop 32, which may have a role here. But one of the items that you mentioned that's so important is the role that parents are really beginning to play in a lot of these school districts where they have been shut out of the process for so long. But there are some places where parents really are in advocating and defending their own children are taking a stronger role in school reform.
Yes, you see that with things like the trigger law that California passed last year, which unfortunately is capped at a small number of schools, but which allows parents to come together and if they reach critical mass to reform a school up to and including turning it into a charter school. And one of the things that is so valuable about this and is so valuable about the general trend of parents standing up is that it changes the moral equation of the argument. You know, it's one thing for people like me or other folks in the media to write a story, to do a radio show, to do a TV appearance, and at a certain point that becomes academic or at least abstract. And it does not have the same resonance with people that it does to see a parent stand up and say, please explain to me why my child, because of the zip code we live in, is not entitled to an education just as good as one 15 miles down the road. It's very, very powerful. And given the huge institutional power that the CTA has, I think only the moral power that comes from that example will in the end be sufficient to combat it.
The name of the title of the piece is The Worst Union in America, and it has been great to have its author and researcher, Troy Senek, with us today. It is from the spring 2012 issue of City Journal, and Troy, it's been great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
This has been Pete Peterson for Pepperdine People. We thank you for listening there at home, and we look forward to joining you the next time. Thanks.